Hello, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, just in the past few weeks, these have been some of the headlines in Miami. Police arrested a second teen in a gang-related shooting outside of Carroll City High School. A teenager was shot outside of a Little Havana supermarket. Last weekend, 6-year-old King Carter was killed when he was caught in crossfire in a Blue Lake village. And Wednesday night, two shootings just blocks away. One teen is dead, another in the hospital. Trinell Harris's son was killed last year, and his case remains unsolved.
The kids that are getting killed now, not even making it to the age to see 18 years old. Change has to come. The silence has to stop. People need to speak up, and more cases can be solved.
Miami-Dade School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho spoke at a press conference Wednesday afternoon after the suspects were identified.
The community, to a certain extent, overcame the fear of reprisal and consequence and empowered law enforcement with the information that led to these arrests. And that's exactly what we need to continue to ask for. At the same time, however, we need to focus also on prevention. It is not just about resolving crimes, it's about preventing crimes.
And more than 30 children and teenagers were killed by gunfire in Miami-Dade in 2015. Community leaders are asking what can be done. Police continue investigating numerous shootings but often run into this no-snitch culture. What makes it hard to find? It makes it hard for them to find answers. There are bills, by the way, right now, House bill and Senate bill, which offers witnesses to a felony a chance to protect their identity. But is that enough? Is this a discussion just about gangs, about guns? What's happening in our community? Joining me now in studio, Nadesh Green, WLRN reporter. Also joining me from Doral at the Miami Herald is Chuck Rabin, Miami Herald reporter covering cops and crime. And here also in studio, Alfredo Ramirez, assistant director of the Miami-Dade Police Department. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining me today.
Good afternoon.
And again, if we had protected witnesses, would that help? Does there have to be more intervention in schools? What are some of the answers? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN or find our Facebook page, The Florida Roundup. When we see all these stories, I'm wondering, is it youth-on-youth violence, or is it just youth caught in the crossfire of gang violence? Is it something else? You know what, Alfredo Ramirez, let me start with you. Really, can you put your finger on one thing and say that's the problem?
Well, yes, I can, actually. Yesterday, I attended the Community Relations Board in the Northside District, where the community came together to talk about the violence that's occurring in our community. And the guest speakers were actually member youth from the community. And when you get the grassroots explanation on what's happening, first of all, the crime is youth on youth. And when you listen, you find out that the simple solution is the most organic solution. And what they're crying for is love. This small percentage of youth that are the most at risk, that live in conditions that are affecting them, their biggest cry is that they're not loved. Okay, they're living in a world, they're growing in a world where they're not giving a direction. Okay, and what society needs as a community, we need to become mentors for these children. The children that do not have the amenities, okay, they're exposed. When they realize they don't have those amenities, they get angry, they get frustrated. And when they walk out in the streets because they fall out of school, they can't do their homework because their home lives have problems, so they're held to a standard that from other students that they can't keep up with. So they come home with that frustration. They make friends with other children who are in that same world. So what happens, they feel they're alone. They're alone. There's no one stepping up for them, talking to them, trying to keep them from making the bad decision. Because yes, a 6-year-old died, but the other three youths that were involved in this senseless killing, their lives are ruined as well. And that bowling ball started rolling a few years before as youth themselves. So this goes all the way around. It's full circle.
Nadesh, that's going deeper than what I had asked at the beginning. A very interesting point, a lack of love with youth. But I'm wondering, what do you think it is? Is it not the parental guidance, parental love? Is it a feeling of desperation? What does that mean?
It's a combination of so many things, like Officer Ramirez says. I was out in an elementary school yesterday speaking to an elementary school teacher. She was talking about reading levels. When you look at the majority of the prison population, many are illiterate or have very low reading levels. So she was talking about even addressing the issue of gun violence, from making sure that these kids are learning how to read and thriving. And so what I hear a lot out in the community is a failure of the institutions, right? The schools, the churches, the institutions in these communities, are they working? Oftentimes we hear no snitch culture. And so the institutions tend to point their fingers at the community and say, well, you guys are not talking about, you know, who's doing the killings. The community points their finger back at the institutions and say, before these killings happen, you have failed us. And so it is multi-layered and complex. You can't say, here's this one thing that, you know, right. This is why this is happening. It is so many different things happening in the community.
And something else that Mr. Ramirez said, too, is the ball was rolling a long time ago. So with a lot of, I think with a lot of bad decisions people make, it always started somewhere else. But I'm curious, at what point does a child or a teenager decide that violence is going to be the solution? They have this lack of institutional help and again, this, as he said, a lack of love. But at what point do they fall and say, and decide violence is going to be it? Violence, I'm going to just enter the find the solution with a gun.
Well, that's what I learned in that meeting and from my previous experiences working in a homicide bureau and being an officer for 20 years. When you feel disenfranchised, you're going to go to your primal instinct. And especially if you're young and you don't have a mentor or any guidance, and you live in a world to them where they feel they're alone, you're going to go to primal instincts. Now, add the component of social media, okay? Let's go back in the day. kids would resolve their issues, and when they would punk somebody out, it would be graffiti on the wall. But on that wall, only three or four people saw it that knew that that graffiti was there. With social media, you got like cyber graffiti, okay? I could go on a page and target you and completely ruin your reputation in front of hundreds of Facebook people that are in your realm. So now you've been virtually humiliated, okay? So if you don't have a strong parent or guidance to tell you, you know what, let's handle this a different way, and you go, you know what, I'm going to get you for this. You just ruined my life and my world and my school, my reputation, all I have, you just destroyed. I'm coming for you. And that's what's going to happen. That is what's happening.
Chuck Rabin, you know, interesting he's talking about the social media aspect. This is what I'm reading about when it comes to the King Carter case. This was a Facebook dispute, and this poor child was just caught in the crossfire. But, I mean, you know, social media playing a role, is it really just kids bullying each other, fighting each other? How much of it's gangs?
There is a component of that.
Sure, it's probably gangs, but as the director will tell you, it's, you know, we don't have the gangs that they do in a lot of other cities. It's more loosely knit. But speaking to what you're saying about when people go to violence, I think you can go back even further than that. I don't think people wake up thinking, I want to be violent. I think it goes to economics. I mean, when you can't eat and don't have food on the table in a lot of cases, what do? Can you blame someone for selling weed or for stealing food? That promotes violence, I guess, in the long run.
And talking about, you had also reported on a gathering last night, I believe it was. It was at Northwest 103rd Street. There were members of the community that came together in remembrance of King Carter. Also, there was a forum titled How to Stop the Shooting at the African Heritage Cultural Arts Center. But really, the people in the community are coming together to discuss the issue. What else was discussed? What came of that discussion?
I actually was at a vigil for David Goulborn, who one of the kids who lost his life the other day. It was one of the other reporters who was at that meeting, so I didn't really take part in that.
And what happened at that vigil?
The director was there. There was an elected official. There were a bunch of groups that came. The family was too distraught to speak. It was pretty solemn. You know, it was in remembrance of him. But I do in the last few weeks, I feel a little bit of a change. Like, people are finally fed up, and, you know, hopefully people like Santonio Carter and others are going to help put, you know, whatever they need to get things turned around.
He says he feels that there's a change, Nadesh.
See, what happens in the community, we've seen this many times, right? After a shooting, there's a march. There is a protest. Elected officials, school officials, community leaders get in front of a podium. They say, we're sorry. Their voices crack. Some might even cry. And they say, not one more. And then another one gets killed. And they show up at a podium. And they say, we're sorry. Their voices crack. They cry. They say, not one more. And then another one. And so there's always this feeling of change when you're in it. But 1 month later, 6 months later, 2 years later, Juwan Cole's case is not solved. He was one of the Miami Northwestern Junior High School students who was killed last year. Randall Robinson case is not solved. He is another Miami Northwestern Senior High School student who was killed last year. So I feel like it's really easy to talk about things when you're in it, but what are the tangible results a year later, 2 years later, that are actually addressing the issue of gun violence, where are guns coming from, and how does a 15-year-old get to carry an AK-47? No one has answered that question.
All right, there are two things that you brought up here. Let's tackle one at a time, because one obviously is prevention, and the other one is going back and trying to solve crimes. Alfredo Ramirez, you know, the other thing that I was looking at on social media, it's not just the bullying, it's not just gangs recruiting, but it's also kids being able to get guns, and they're doing it online. So what efforts are there right now in trying to maybe put a stop to that? How are they doing it, by the way? Is it just easy as somebody communicating with each other on Facebook or Twitter and saying, this is how you can get a weapon?
From what I see in my experience, the weapons are retrieved in the street. Okay, that's where the guns are coming from the adults passed over to the youth. They're circulating amongst the community. That's what's happening. They're taken either through the black market, through burglarizing people's homes. They get filtered into the community, and they're sold around. Sometimes people with felony pass in the community will have a child hold the gun because they know that if they get stopped by the police, the kid has a gun. I don't have the gun. You see? So they're used as, you know, proxies. Okay, and then you're introducing that youth into the world of firearm. It's accessible. What we do for enforcement, we do a lot on it. We have a gunfire squad. We work with a partnership with ATF where we go after felons with firearms. Okay, our homicide street violence task force that we have, everything is geared towards gun violence. Our whole enforcement apparatus is strategic. It's not a shock and all approach. We're strategic. We work a lot with the community, with information that we get and tips, and we strategically go after these individuals who are pushing this virus into our community.
The other thing, too, is this discussion of some of these cases, and this leads to this question of the no snitch culture. But is that really the issue? The biggest issue here is trying to get people to come forward and talk about crimes, or is there something else?
I mean, solving the crimes is great.
Chuck Raven, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. Solving the crimes is fantastic, but I mean, you've got to get to the root of the issue, right? I mean, whether it's economics, whether it's a father not home, whether, you know, whatever it is. I mean, you don't want the crime to happen in the first place.
But Chuck Raven, though, you mentioned that, and it seems like that's a cultural shift, right? I mean, is it something? It's not something that's going to be that easy. I'm not saying that solving a crime is, but I'm just saying which one would be easier to do.
It would be easier not to get people's children killed. I mean, forget, you know, solving the crime. Like, how about we talk about not having the crime happen?
Right.
How about we talk about not having to worry about King Carter being killed? Amir Castro was in elementary school. He was gunned down.
What are people in the community asking, and who are they asking for help in trying to stop this?
It's across all platforms. I've heard community members point the fingers at themselves, saying we need to do better as a community. Forget other people helping us. I think at this point, some members of the community are quite cynical when it comes to the institutions to begin with. So they're like, what can we do to help ourselves? But then you do have members of the community who say, what can the police do? I know I've heard from several police officers who patrol these areas who talk about talking to the kids more, mentoring. I heard a Miami-Dade police officer the other day speaking with Booker T. Washington High School students, and she was like, you know what, maybe we need to find a way to get into the schools more. I mean, she was talking about the school's police are in the school. She was like, but maybe we should find a way to be in the schools more. And so I'm hearing more of these conversations. But like I said earlier, they're just conversations. How do you go beyond just talking?
Officer Ramirez, go ahead.
We're doing that. I'll tell you that right now. We are doing that. That is part of our community policing model. It's engagement. We don't want arrests or tickets. We're looking for a connection. That's our motto. We want a connection. We want to stop. You talk about the circle of violence with youth. Remember, these children are doing these crimes, 17 and 18. We want to get them at 8, 9, 10 years old. What we're focusing on is the most at-risk zip codes, okay? And we want to create a mentorship program with kids that are at risk so that the officer comes during their patrols. They are assigned that child, and they're watching them, they're helping them, they're making sure that he's moving or he or she is moving along.
What's the response, though, of those children and the community? Well, are they reaching out to you and saying, hey, you're welcome in here, please come in?
I believe that we're developing rapidly a great relationship with the community. The community's fed up. They're looking for answers. They need help. We're there. The police are the front line. They make the most contact with us. We're the ones that when they need help, they call the police.
I still want to ask about this no snitch culture. Okay. And again, as I said, there's a bill right now, a couple of bills in the House and the Senate that would give a little bit more protection to people who do witness crimes and felonies. But before I get to you, Officer Ramirez, Nadesh, coming back to you, though, so the community says that they have to look to themselves for answers, but they also know this is one of the problems within the community. Where's that problem coming in? Why don't people want to talk? Is it just fear of retaliation, or is there something else?
It's mostly fear of retaliation. A lot of these cases, even when there is an arrest, falls apart. So you don't want to go talking about, you know, your next door neighbor who has an AK-47 who did this thing, because guess what? When that case falls apart, you're still living in the neighborhood with that person's cousins, that person's brothers, maybe the gang affiliation folks who are still in that neighborhood. And so when people talk about no snitch, it's kind of like, oh, no snitch culture, you all just don't want to talk. There is a very real, tangible fear in the neighborhood. I went out to near Miami Northwestern where a young man was gunned down. His family says he was gunned down because he was cooperating with the police. And so this isn't like some make-believe Hollywood thing, like, oh, they just don't want to talk because of no snitch. People are afraid that they're going to get killed, that their mother's house is going to get shot up. As an example for the neighborhood, this is what happens to you when you talk.
So, Officer Ramirez, how are you welcomed into a community if there are people who are afraid that if they're seen with you, something's going to happen to them?
Okay. First, I'll tell you what you're doing and what we're doing, and I could tell you if there's total inaction, the body count's going to grow, okay? Everybody has to step up. Unfortunately, we're in the middle of fighting a terrible plague that's growing in our community with our youth. Number one, when we work a case in homicide, we have mechanism through the state attorney's office where we have funding, where we relocate a lot of witnesses. And we spend a lot of money. And the state only funds a small amount. I think it's $100,000 for the whole state of Florida, of which Miami-Dade County is the biggest recipient. Then our department absorbs that. Our mayor is willing to put money to take on that expense so that we could protect our witnesses, because it's true. The murder cases are circumstantial, and it's true. It's not cowardliness from the community. They got to live there. Okay, it's a real threat, and it's a small, and let me tell you, the community is strong, and let me tell you that it's a small amount of people who are creating a lot of problems. It's not the whole community. The community cares. There are hardworking people, and they don't need this happening in their community, and we work together with the police, and we do everything we can. We have their back to protect them, but if you don't step up, the body count is, if there's inaction, the body count's going to grow.
Chuck Rabin, you mentioned this a little while ago, too, and I'm just curious, is it just, as we kind of heard, they're just a small group of people who are causing a lot of problem? Or, again, how big is the gang issue?
It's not a huge group of people, and if you talk to the director, he'll tell you that you see the same people over and over again, and the people they're affiliated with that are causing the problem. But going back to, you know, the other stuff we were talking about, there's never a single answer to anything. It's got to be a combination of everything to make things better. It's got to start with the family. It's got to start with whatever help they need. It's got to go to the police. I mean, it's got to be the schools. It has to be everybody.
Nadesh, as we finish up, just what you were saying a moment ago hit me, and I'm wondering, you know, we'll sadly have another one, and then you're going to see leaders again standing at the podium. But really, if that's going to happen, who is it that has to step up? I understand what you said, that the community has to look at itself, but I wonder sometimes if there isn't just one person that has to stand up, or a small group of people, and take the lead and say, you know, and again, not taking anything away from what the police are doing. They're doing their job, though. But if somebody else has to stand up and say, okay, it's on us, let's go forward.
I feel that because we're now seeing elementary school age kids being killed, right? It used to be a time where you thought there were certain members of our community that were untouchable. That, you know, when a 20-year-old is killed, that is a tragedy. When a 16-year-old is killed, that's a tragedy. When a 12-year-old is killed, that's a tragedy. Now we're talking about 6-year-olds being killed. And I think that may be the tipping point. But you know what? I've heard this before. I've heard that after 8 people were shot up in front of the Pork and Beans, that was the tipping point because of the amount of people who were shot. It wasn't. So I'm not sure what that answer will be. It will be incumbent upon the community, the institutions in the communities, and whether or not there will be actual action and not just a bunch of town halls and summits where people come together and talk about it and pat themselves on the back that we talked about it, but didn't do anything.
Do you think of any community anywhere where you see them doing something right that we should? No. Okay. And Officer Ramirez, I'm going to give you the last word as we finish up here, is, you know, what else can you do? You know, again, you're trying to connect with young people to catch them early on and show them that they can work with you. But what else could you possibly do? And again, I think of this, if these bills don't pass, there are a lot of people who are just not going to want to talk to you.
Okay. We're never going to stop doing, okay? Even if we have to take the burden ourselves as a police officer, that's what we do. We're here to protect the community. We'll find another way. We're not giving up on the community, and especially our children. That's not going to happen, okay? We'll keep coming up with ideas like we're doing, keeping the connection. We don't do mass arrests because what we've learned is we need the community to trust us. That's where it starts. There's two things where this starts from. What I told you in the beginning about love for our children and trust with the community. Those are the two things that bonds everything together for law enforcement. We're not going to quit.
And I've also heard many times before, you cannot arrest your way to a solution. Officer Alfredo Ramirez is the Assistant Director of the Miami-Dade Police Department. We also heard from Chuck Rabin, Miami Herald reporter for covering cops and crime, and Nadege Green, WLRN reporter. Thank you so much, everybody. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thanks.
All right, who is Marco Rubio, and does he really have any chance of winning this nomination? We'll talk about that coming up here on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. All right, did you watch the debate last night? Got a little spicy, didn't it? Seems as the number of candidates in the race whittles down, it gets more and more heated. Well, what did you think? Did it sway you in any way? Donald Trump still the front runner as we go into Super Tuesday, and the latest Quinnipiac poll, University poll, shows that Donald Trump is leading by a lot here in the Sunshine State. But did last night's debate sway you in any way? What are you thinking as you're moving forward toward the March 15th Florida primary? Well, you know, we're going to talk a lot about Marco Rubio and how he performed last night. And who is Marco Rubio, and does he have a chance in this race? We are joined by SV Date, National Journal White House correspondent, and Mary Ellen Klass from Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau Chief. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. All right, so looking at last night's debate, Marco Rubio, did he do himself any favor or did he hurt himself in any way? SV Date, how was his performance?
I guess what happened last night was what the establishment wing of the party has been hoping was going to happen for months. Someone was going to take on Donald Trump repeatedly, often, and just make it clear that Trump is not the successful businessman that he claims to be, is not a serious person, and really has no business running for president. Marco Rubio did that. Is it too late? Well, it's only, 4 days now from Super Tuesday. This is the sort of thing that probably should have been happening last fall if they wanted to be sure it was going to work. I don't know. I guess we'll find out Tuesday evening.
Mary Ellen Klass, you know what? We're coming up on Super Tuesday, but also thinking about the March 15th Florida primary, and Marco Rubio is still trailing Donald Trump in his own state. I mean, he still has a few weeks before that, but really, is it too late?
I think that one of the things that's been pretty remarkable is that everybody from the media to the political establishment has underestimated Donald Trump. So Rubio finds himself in a really unusual position. He not only watched as Jeb Bush left the race, but now as he turns to Florida, he is on the defensive because Trump is on the ascendancy here, according to all the polls. I think it's a remarkable situation. I don't know if it's too late, but I think he actually has an uphill climb.
The number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can tweet us at WLRN. You can also find us on our Facebook group, The Florida Roundup. We'd like to hear your thoughts. What did you think of last night's debate? If you're a Rubio supporter, do you think it's too late? Do you think he has a chance? Again, look at the latest poll. Donald Trump leads in Florida. I'm not even talking about Super Tuesday yet. So Again, 800-743-WLRN. We'd like to hear your thoughts. Maybe you think Donald Trump's already got this in the bag. You know what, SV Date, I want to talk a little bit about Marco Rubio and who he is. Now, we still have a couple of Florida candidates, Dr. Ben Carson as well, and didn't hear a whole lot from him. He may drop out by after Super Tuesday if he doesn't have a good showing. Many candidates may be dropping out by Super Tuesday. But, you know, I mean, Marco Rubio, we hear a lot about he's young, he's inexperienced, comparisons to, you know, President Obama going in as a young, inexperienced senator. But we don't hear a lot more about his background. Is that on purpose? Are they trying to hide his background, hide some of his history? Or is there just not enough of it there?
Right. Well, I think there is not very much of it there. And I think the best guide to what Marco Rubio is about is read his memoir, An American Son, because in it he kind of lays out what he did and how he did it. He was in a rush. He wanted to get someplace fast. He didn't really like his day jobs that he had, is working as a land use lawyer slash lobbyist, however you want to describe it. And he didn't really want to be in a position of having to put himself making bad votes, coercing other people to make bad votes when he was trying to climb up leadership in the Florida House. In fact, he points out that he was never even really chairman of a committee until just before he became speaker because he didn't have time. And so it's kind of telling how he describes it. A lot of folks in D.C. loved that he didn't have much of a background because it's hard to say negative things about someone when he hasn't cast that many votes. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. As you point out, there's been a lot of comparisons with him and then-Senator Obama back in 2008. But for those folks, I suggest that they read Obama's first memoir and then read Marco Rubio's memoir and then compare the kind of person who wrote each one and, you know, decide for yourself.
Mary Ellen Klass, you look at his time in the Florida legislature and, you know, again, maybe as SV Dante said, that not having a lot of history might be to his advantage. But is there any one thing that stands out about his time in Tallahassee?
Well, he came, you know, first of all, he was Speaker of the House, which is, you know, one of the highest offices you can get in Florida. However, anybody who knows anything about how Florida elects its House speakers is often much more an accident of circumstance than a test of their policy credentials or their leadership stripes. And Marco Rubio really got lucky. After term limits, Florida had a massive amount of turnover, and Rubio was a redshirt freshman in 2000, the first year that term limits took effect, and it was one of the largest freshman classes of legislators in Florida state history. That class had to elect a leader, and Rubio, with his telegenic and articulate charisma, was sort of chosen as the guy, the go-to guy. So he was immediately coalesced support. And it also helped that he was from Miami because Florida had not seen a Speaker of the House from Miami in decades. So he emerges, and as I said, he doesn't have a lot of political or policy credentials to go with. As Sharish mentioned, he didn't even have a experience as a committee chairman. The two years before he became Speaker, he did chair a committee that changed land use law. It was actually eminent domain-related issues and some court-related issues. So it was a little bit of a heavy lift, and I think he showed some good ability to coalesce people to reach a compromise
on
that.
So what I'm gathering, though, is that there was this rush. He had this rush in his career, and he seemed to accomplish a lot very quickly, but the question is, what exactly did he accomplish in that time? Again, if you're having a hard time getting through the phones, you can always find us on Twitter at WLRN or on Facebook, the Florida Roundup Group. Let us know your thoughts about last night's debate, and does it help Ruby or not? Maybe you've got another guy you're voting for. Let me go to Larry in Miami. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, I've been following Mr. Rubio's career since, when he was in the city commission in West Miami. And there isn't much substance or accomplishments to it. I mean, you could take people who are complete outsiders, including the current governor, and like it or not, he's doing things. You know, like, bad or good, when someone actually can accomplish something, bad means I don't like it. Some other people obviously do. So I would have a hard time placing this particular person, not who he is or where he's from or his background, but this human being that is named Marco Rubio in the office of president. But on top of that, I think you've seen the beautiful thing about Trump running, having done polling, is he's an indicator. Trump's number stays the same, goes up, it goes down, but it's never going to be any higher than the highest point it reaches.
So you don't think Rubio doesn't have any chance at this point?
Well, if you vote for people because they're pretty, which is like normally what happens, you know, that's what reality television is more popular in politics. If you vote for someone that's pretty, then you're going to vote for Marco Rubio because he's pretty. But that's not enough to be president of the United States. I mean, keep in mind, we still are the world's police.
All right, Larry.
Like it or not.
Larry, thank you so much for the call. I got to stop you there because I got a lot of calls. I got very little time. Larry, thank you so much for the call. All right, so he's pretty, but does he have the experience? All right, let me go to Lionel in Miami. Lionel, you don't think Rubio will be the nominee?
Lionel,
go ahead. You're here.
Okay, great. No, I don't think he'll be the nominee. Neither do I think Ted Cruz will be. I think that the history may repeat itself if Jeb Bush makes a deal with Trump, just like his father did with Reagan, and they will win the national election that way. But otherwise, the Republicans won't have a chance.
All right, so wait a minute. You brought Jeb Bush back into this picture.
Yes. I think he will be a great vice president for Trump.
All right. Well, we talked about this the other day. Thank you so much, Lionel. Appreciate the call. We talked about a Washington Post article that had already started listing VP possibilities if Donald Trump wins the candidacy. And now, well, we got a call here that Jeb Bush may be that person. All right. Again, let me jump back to the phones. I want to go to Sherry in Fort Lauderdale. Sherry, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Go ahead, Sherry.
I was just wondering if your panel or any caller could comment on what exactly it is about Donald Trump's platform and what exactly that is that's attracting them to him, other than speaks his mind.
Okay. All right. Well, let's find out.
And the other thing, can I just make one more comment?
Real quickly.
I'm as a person born here and I live in Miami, actually, and my friends from the ages of between 30 and 50 who are of Latin, not one of them supports
Marco Rubio,
Rubio, Trump. They're all Bernie Sanders fans.
Okay.
And some Hillary.
All right.
And they're all Latin, from every Latin American country.
Sherry, thank you so much for the call, and thank
you're
you
welcome.
For sharing that. All right, so let me, you know what, and I think I did lose one of my guests, but Mary Ellen Klass, you are still there. You know what, we get that question about what is it about Donald Trump? And we've seen the... we've seen the number of candidates whittled down to just really a three-man race at this point. But what is it that he has that neither Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio have?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the experience factor, he's built an empire. I think people look at that, but I also think that he is, you know, a lot of pundits have observed, he is talking about the anti-establishment argument and he's not one of them. And I think tapping into the voter anger, the sense that people, even the irony is, even people in Nevada who are Hispanics and are not who you would think would be offended by so many of the things he said, you know, he won a majority of their vote. So I think, you know, he's tapping a nerve, and I think that is what is surprising everybody.
And we keep hearing that as a common theme, is that there's a voter anger, and he's the one who is, as you just said, he's tapping into that. Also, something interesting is the fact that he does say whatever he wants, and it seems like people are just taking it in, and they're not as offended maybe as we think. You know, maybe we are overestimating who Donald Trump is really for the voters this time around. Let me go to Barry in Aventura. Barry, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Go ahead, Barry.
Can you hear me? Yes. Okay, I've been a resident of Florida for the last 35 years, a citizen for 50 years, and I've been voting Democrat all this year. Twice I voted the Republican, Reagan and the Bush fathers. I was extremely disappointed last night with this debate with Rubio. Rubio acted extremely immature. For example, that Donald Trump was making a comment about the insurance. If you sell insurance in New Jersey, you cannot sell it in New York. If you sell it in New York, this is something very simple that most people understand. And he goes and he's talking about, what all these children, all this circle that you're making like children?
Okay,
this
so really, you thought...
I think he's not mature. He's young and handsome and smart. In my opinion, you should wait another 4 years or 8 years, or maybe make a deal with Donald Trump, work with him to bring him the Hispanic. 8 years from now, I would vote for him 100%. He's very smart.
Barry,
by the way.
Thank you. No, I have to let you go. Barry, thank you so much. All right, so he's too young, and maybe if he waits 8 years. So as we wrap up, SV Date, I've got your back real quickly. You know, we keep hearing this, not just here locally, but nationally as well, that Donald Trump is connecting with people's anger. But we did just hear that, you know, really, maybe perhaps some of these candidates like Marco Rubio, too young, might have to wait some time. Is that the case? Is it just one of those things where he's a little bit young if he waited 4 or 8 years, maybe?
Well, that's a question. If he makes it as the nominee, that's a question for the general election audience, because at this point, who's left to beat him? I mean, if Trump doesn't win it, I think Marco Rubio is probably best situated to be the nominee. If he's too young, if he's too young looking, if he doesn't have the policy depth, I wonder if that matters anymore. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the reasons he's done so well already is that the Washington conservative media loved him. And the reason they loved him is they had very little actual voting experience in voting history. They thought that they could make him whatever needed to be made of him in order to win the nomination in the presidency. They saw in him basically Republican Barack Obama in their view. So, yeah, too young, that's going to be in the eye of the general election
we shall
voter
see.
If it gets that far.
Super Tuesday is coming up. Again, Florida's primary coming up March 15th. And, hey, whatever you want to say, this is still a fascinating election season, no doubt about it. SV Date, again, National Journal White House correspondent, and Mary Ellen Klass, Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau Chief. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
All right. Well, we are releasing billions of gallons of water from Lake Okeechobee out into the ocean. That's causing a lot of problems for people, for businesses. We're going to find out what's going on. That's coming up next on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You've probably seen the pictures, if not the videos, this dark mass of dark water moving through the estuaries out into the seas on both the east and west coast. This stuff is just a stark difference between the beautiful aquamarine water that we're so used to. What is it? Well, that murky, frothy, dark water is coming from Lake Okeechobee because the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had to open up the floodgates to release billions of gallons of this stuff because the lake was filling up. Is there a solution? What is it doing, by the way, not only to people who are out trying to enjoy the beautiful beaches that we have in South Florida, but also to businesses? We've heard some towns talking about a state of emergency because it's going to affect their businesses, their economy. Well, joining me now is Andy Reid. He covers environmental issues for the Sun Sentinel, and Jenny Stiletovich, Miami Herald environmental reporter. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. Jenny, let me start with you real quickly. I've seen this on the west coast of Florida when I was out living in Fort Myers, but the water's released to both sides, to both coasts. What do we know about what's going on here on the east coast?
Well, the black water that you talked about is sediment, basically, in the water. It turns it that blackish color. There are monitoring stations at Harbor Branch set up where they are able to kind of detect the spike in sediment that started about the same time as the water was released from the lake. But, you know, they're still trying to figure out exactly where that sediment comes from. One of the scientists I talked to this week said that it's going to take a couple of years to nail it down. I know the Water Management District has said, you know, some of that is local basin runoff, and some of it's from the lake. But ultimately, it's spreading out over the coast, and it's raising a lot of concerns about the seagrasses that, you know, need a lot of sunlight to grow, and coral and other marine life.
Yeah, Andy Reid, I mean, I've heard, you know, different people in different reports up and down the East Coast talk about it's, I mean, not only does it just, it's really looks terrible, it smells bad as well, but it is affecting businesses, fishermen, you know, businesses along the coast. But what are you hearing about what people see and what it's doing to their livelihood?
Well, even if the water was pure and clean coming into the estuaries, it would be trouble because of that amount of fresh water mixing in these normally salty estuaries is just bad for the habitat there. And you mix in the added sediment that washes in with the water, the high levels of nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, other pollution that washes in with it. And it really can decimate oyster beds, seagrass beds, which are the spawning grounds for marine life in the estuaries, which are so important to tourism, fishing, and the other related industries. And just having water that's clean and people want to come stay at the beach next to, and not having that is a big effect on the economies.
But here's the situation then, is that we have Lake Okeechobee is filling up. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says, well, we have to worry about the dike, so we have to release some of this water. So we have to protect that system. We now have to release this water. But it's obviously causing problems elsewhere. Is there a win-win at all in this?
No, the frustrating thing in particular for folks who live in these dumping grounds in the estuaries is that it's a flood control solution to a flooding problem they don't have. The situation in Lake Okeechobee is the water's corralled there to prevent flooding downstream, to allow South Florida to develop the way that it did, to allow sugarcane to be where it is, to basically allow building and farming in the Everglades. They corral water in Lake Okeechobee. That's a big part of that. And when the lake level rises too high, it poses a threat to the dike around the lake that's considered one of the most at risk in the country of failing and is undergoing a rehab project. And when the water gets too high, it gets shunted, flushed out to the coast. The long-term solution is supposed to be Everglades restoration, a host of projects to build reservoirs and water treatment areas to try to restore the natural flow of water south from Lake Okeechobee down through the Everglades to Florida Bay. But that's been a slow-moving process, frustratingly slow for the folks involved.
And Jenny Saladovich, some of that water, they have started to let it flow, I guess what used to be the old natural flow down into the Everglades, they have started to because of the fact that, well, we can't just keep dumping it east and west. But what do we know about what that's done? And is that effective anymore?
Well, what happened this year with all the heavy rain in the El Nino year is the water conservation areas filled up, so they have to lower that water, make room in there. So they basically sped up an Everglades restoration project and started moving water into Everglades National Park.
Now, you know what? I'd read that scientists from Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute, they've said that these Lake Okeechobee discharges have a bigger impact than they did in the summer of 2013. So real quickly, Andy Reid, what happened in 2013? How would you compare the two?
Well, it's I think part of the reason for that is it's sort of a cumulative effect. The estuaries had begun to recover from what happened in 2013, and now they're getting socked again. I think what's a little bit different this time around is it's maybe higher level releases earlier in the year, a larger amount of water coming out of the lake. They've gone to basically maximum releases, or at least allowing themselves the opportunity for that. And over a longer period of time, that could be more damaging for the estuary. So you've got the fact that they've suffered through the years. Now they're getting a bigger, potentially dose of water this year that could last all the way into the summer. And it's just trouble for the area.
And it's taken that long for them to recover from 2013? We were just now getting to the point where we're recovering from
that? Well, I can't say that it's taken until this, right at the moment when these releases started this year. But there's a lag time. After this happens, when the releases stop, there's a period where you need a time for recovery.
The number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. If you live in one of these areas where this water is impacting your livelihood, we'd like to hear your thoughts. Again, this runoff that we're basically opening the floodgates and letting out a lot of this water from Lake Okeechobee out into the estuaries, now affecting a lot of beaches. We'd like to hear from you. What have you seen? Have you seen that dark water come through? Tell us what that's like. 800-743-WLRN. Jenny Staletovich, coming back to the question of what happened in 2013. I'm trying to get a figure of how long does it usually take to clear up. What do we know about that?
I actually don't know exactly how long it takes to clear up. I talked to a fishing guide up there this week who said that his business is still recovering. So I think you have, in addition to the ecosystem, there's a perception. So especially tourism businesses have to kind of rebound after that.
All right, I want to go to the phones because we have some folks who are sharing their stories with us. Let me start with Bob in West Palm Beach. Bob, you are a recreational fisherman. What's it like for you right now?
Well, I'm not fishing. I live in West Palm Beach. I used to work with Jenny at the Post. Hey, Jenny.
Hi.
And I do kayak fishing, which is a very popular form of it. And for the last year or so, or up until a few months ago, we were driving up to the Treasure Coast area, Stewart, Fort Pierce, Bureau, every week to fish. You know, that would mean a tank of gas. We'd usually stop for lunch up there. You'd hit tackle stores and things like that. And now I'm not going to go in that water. It's dangerous, they tell us. There's all kinds of, you know, algaes and things like that that, you know, I mean, there's been reports of people being very sick from swimming in the water up there. And
so you're just going to avoid it. You're going to avoid it altogether, basically.
If I fish, I go in the freshwater lakes and things right now because, you know, I'm not going to step into that water. It's hazardous. And then the problem is the turbidity is killing the seagrass bed.
Yeah, and we talked about that as well. Bob, I got to let you go. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for sharing that. You know what, I Andy Reid, is there a risk, a health risk to people just being in that water that you know of?
Not at the moment, as far as I know. If this situation continues for a long period of time, toxic algae blooms or a consequence of these kind of prolonged discharges. When that happens, that's when you have a human health risk, and warning signs will go up for folks to try to stay out of the water.
All right, let me go to Katie in Fort Lauderdale. Katie was out in Sanibel, so that's on the West Coast. Katie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
What did you see?
When we went over to Sanibel during Valentine's Day weekend, the amount of dead mullet and fish on the surface of the water was very disturbing, and the color of the water closer to where it's flowing out of the river compared to out in the Gulf was dramatically different, from brown to then the normal crystal blue and green.
Yeah.
Just very disruptive. My concern would be more of, is it the freshwater alone that's causing the issue, or the runoff from the sugar plants that's more destructive to the environment?
All right, Katie, thank you so much for the call, and I appreciate sharing that with us. Yeah, and Sanibel, beautiful area. Sorry that you had to have that experience during the Valentine's Day holiday. But Jenny Stolatovich, she asked the question, though, is it more the runoff from Lake Okeechobee or some of the other issues that she had mentioned?
Well, early on, they back pumped from the sugar fields into the lake, but that only lasted for 4 days. Oh, I think the bigger issue here is, the water coming down, especially on the West Coast, is kind of a muddy brown color from the tannins and the ground colors the water. And like Andy said, it's a problem of fresh water hitting these estuaries that are normally salty, especially in the Indian River Lagoon. And when you have that shock of fresh water, it can be pretty damaging to marine life.
All right, let me take one more call real quickly. Spencer in Hollywood, who's been out to the beach and sees the impact. Spencer, tell us what you see real quickly.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just, I work at the Westin on North Fort Lauderdale Beach, and it really, you know, usually my job is directly affected by the tourism and the people coming in, and usually this time of year we have lots of Europeans, and they, you know, they're not affected by the temperature of the water, so they love being in the water. And now it's kind of dying out because the water is just brackish, really dark, and, you know, Florida prides itself in having really clear, perfect, awesome water, sea to the bottom.
Yeah, you're pointing it out. You're telling us exactly what you see, which is what we've seen in some of these photos and some of these videos. Spencer, thank you so much for the call. Real quickly, as I finish up, Andy Reid, in like 10, 15 seconds, just, you know what, it's one of these things, again, you said the health risk could be there later, but what do you tell people if they ask you, how long is this going to last? I want to enjoy the water again.
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers will tell you they expect to keep releasing water for months to come, and it could last into the summer rainy season, so that this could be an ongoing issue.
Could be an ongoing issue. Andy Reid covers environmental issues for the Sun Sentinel. Jenny Stolatovich, Miami Herald environmental reporter. Thank you both so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that is the program. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy your weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez in for Tom Hunt, and he's back next week. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN.